This is the Oanda Podcast, brought to you by Jazz FM's Business Breakfast.
You're listening to the Oanda Market Insights Podcast with me, Johnny Hart. To look back on another fascinating week and look ahead to the next 7 days, I'm joined by Oanda Senior Market Analyst Craig Earlham in London and Ed Moyer in New York. Hello, guys.
Good afternoon.
Thank you for having us.
It's a pleasure. So just 10 days to go now before the US elections. Last night's presidential debate, well, there wasn't really a big win for either, let alone a knockout blow, but both actually did fairly well. They're calling it a score draw in some quarters. Have, Ed, the markets now factored in a Biden win? I mean, it's certainly looking that way.
I'm going to sound like a broken record, but yes, I think the markets are still pretty confident that the Democratic nominee is going to win. I think President Trump had a better outing. This was a civil debate. I think many people were happy that policies were discussed and we got to learn more from both candidates. However, I think that you're going to look at the polls, and right now there's just I think Biden has too much of a lead. And when you take a look at what happened, early voting has been amazing. We've seen over 40 million Americans vote before that debate. So if we have record turnout, it's possibly that a third of the population has already cast their ballot. So I think you're going to see that many Americans have already made up their mind. When you compare this election to the one with us against Secretary Hillary Clinton, the undecided vote is roughly half of that. So I think we had 4 years for the people to get the polls right. They did a poor job in covering a big part of the Trump base. And I think that the polls are going to be a little bit more accurate this go around. And now we're going to see if any big changes happen in these final days leading up to the election day. But I think right now you're right that markets are firmly pricing in a Biden presidency. But the Senate is the big question mark. I think those races are still too tight. And we're going to see that ultimately is going to dictate where we see a lot of these markets go. Because with a blue wave, you're going to see that is going to be very positive for huge infrastructure spending. Yes, we'll have higher taxes and tougher regulation, but I think the markets are kind of pricing that in. And if we do get the Republicans keeping the Senate, gridlock will be here. So you don't have to worry about those taxes and regulations, but we will see a lot smaller stimulus come into the economy. So a lot at stake with these Senate races. And right now they're still too tight to feel comfortable that either side will win.
And you mentioned voting turnout. Many voters just didn't turn out last time. And if you take a state like Florida, where, for instance, hundreds and thousands of black voters just stayed at home, but it seems to be very different this time around. And that could actually affect votes for the Senate as well.
Very much so. I think right now what you're seeing is if you take a look at who this pandemic has hurt the most, it's been Latinos and the black voter. And I think you're going to probably see record turnout. This has been a key part of the population that both sides are trying to win their votes over. And I think that for the most part, you're going to see that Biden's efforts as far as providing more support and into extending these unemployment benefits and providing more opportunities and trying to create new jobs is resonating well with these voters. So I think also when you take a look at who COVID has hurt the most, it's been those pockets of people. So I think right now you're going to see that investors are going to probably expect for the president to struggle in winning those votes. And I think that's why you're going to see come election day, if Florida goes quickly to Biden, I think you're going to see many people kind of feel that that's good enough to price that in. Now, there's still going to be a tremendous amount of uncertainty because we have mail-in voting, and a lot of that counting won't take place until November 3rd. But I think the election uncertainty risks have eased, but they still might be tight, and we might not have final answers on the Senate Well, much later, so possibly a couple months later. So that's going to be very close to follow, and that will really dictate how people position themselves with risky assets. So still a lot of question marks, but at least on the presidential election, I think markets are pretty confident that it's leaning towards Biden.
Craig, how does a Biden win, should that happen, affect the UK and Europe? We're going to talk about Brexit in a minute as well, but of course we're going to have to sign a trade agreement with the USA in the not too distant future. We hope it's not in the too distant future. But what's the difference between Biden and Trump when it comes to the UK economy?
I'm not convinced there is an enormous difference. I think we often have to ignore a lot of what is said in the media because it's said for a particular purpose. We'll remember back in 2016, Barack Obama effectively saying at David Cameron's request that the UK would be right at the back of the queue if it voted to leave in terms of a new trade deal. I think we all know that's probably not true. And I think Biden is going to toe the same line as Barack Obama. And we've actually heard kind of similar tones from the former vice president in relation to that. But again, I just don't believe that that's necessarily true. I think the two countries are extremely close and important partners in many ways. And therefore, this idea of going to the back of the queue, I don't think anyone really buys into. Obviously, on Trump's side, there is an urgency to create a trade deal with the UK. You can see that it is a relationship which does actually mean a lot to President Trump. So maybe there may be a little bit more urgency, but then you could argue that maybe the negotiations may be that little bit tougher. So there's probably some minor pros and cons, but broadly speaking, I don't think it makes a huge difference. I think the biggest difference comes from the White House's relationship with Europe as a whole. I think one of the interesting things in last night's debate was Biden effectively attacking Trump for making allies of enemies and enemies of allies over the course of the last 4 years. And I think that's been quite clear for all to see within various organizations at various summits, etc. That's going to be the biggest difference because I think Biden will want to repair relations with traditional allies at the expense of those who Trump has sought to reach out to in the last 4 years, the obvious ones being Putin and Xi and others. So I think that's going to be the biggest difference as far as I'm concerned.
Okay, we'll talk more about Brexit in a moment or two, Craig, but I just wanted to ask you, Ed, about US earnings, some interesting earnings out this week, and we've got a fiscal stimulus in the plans as well.
Yes, very much so. I'll talk with the latter first. This fiscal stimulus is pretty much, it seems that that'll be a post-election event, more likely a January discussion. I think that you're seeing that House Speaker Pelosi and Treasury Secretary Mnuchin are not making enough progress. The big issue at stakes remain funding to state and local governments and also liabilities. And right now there's no expectations that you're going to have that progress. And even if we do, the House Senate Majority Leader McConnell is not going to play ball. It's very unlikely that you're going to get the 60 votes that are needed to pass that legislation. So I think that it's still an uphill battle for that, and I think we won't really have that stimulus question answered until we have those election results. And with regard to earnings, I think this week's been it's been the busiest week. We've third. The second week has seen lots of nice surprises. Southwest Airlines, Freeport, McMoRan, Coca-Cola, and AT&T had good results. Tesla, one of the more exciting stocks that people follow. They for the most part, I think you're seeing that they had their best quarter ever. And there's still a tremendous optimism as far as Elon Musk and his not just building cars, but the batteries and just expanding the offerings that Tesla is going to provide, and they'll probably spin off into other companies. But the valuations just seem extremely Just too high right now and unjustified. And I think, you're still seeing, despite the strong report, Tesla shares are somewhat lower. And when you take a look at the other big tech earnings that we got, it was Netflix. And that Netflix has a tough battle ahead of them. The competition is growing. They disappointed with their new subscriber growth. So you're seeing a little bit of fatigue here with mega cap tech. I think that's going to be something that everyone closely watches, because tech has really been the key driver throughout the pandemic. And if we see tech decline, if it doesn't go into the cyclicals, then you'll have people become more concerned about that sell-off. But for now, I think that earnings have been going pretty solidly so far, better than expected, and it's been constructive so far.
Okay, Craig, let's talk some Brexit now. And Michel Barnier,
Yippee.
I thought you'd be pleased. Michel Barnier and his team, the EU team of diplomats, are in London at the moment, and I think bidding to avoid a no-deal Brexit. You can't really tell. They don't want a no-deal Brexit, and I'm not sure about our side. When I say our side, I'm talking about the UK government. But Number 10 has warned that significant gaps remain between the two sides, particularly over fishing. And in the grand scheme of things, fishing doesn't really add up to that much cash in the end. It's more of a symbolic thing, isn't it?
It's extremely symbolic, and I think that's something that we have to remember. But we've talked about fishing more in the last 4 years than I think we have ever before. But it has become a symbol of Brexit. So if Boris Johnson concedes, it's going to be seen as a negotiation failure, and that's why such a big issue has been made of it over the course of the last few weeks. I mean, from the outside looking in, I think you can look at the last week and say that it seemed extremely petty calling off negotiations because of some nasty and harsh sounding words, and because of the belief that the other side isn't yielding as much as you want them to, and this, that, and the other. So just kind of walking away and throwing your things in the air, it doesn't seem like the best solution. But I think we have to remember in all of this that politics and PR is always important, and the perception at home on how things are going is almost as important. How many people are actually going to read the final deal that the UK and the EU strike, both here in the UK and over there? Very, very few. So the PR is going to be an important aspect to people deciding whether it's been a worthwhile venture, whether it's been successful, and who's won out of it. And in a weird way, it is a zero-sum game, but in a weird way, every side needs to feel like they've got the better end of the deal. And I think Boris Johnson and his team probably felt that not only was the negotiation not progressing as they wanted it to, but I think they also looked at the comments which came out of the EU summit last week, and they decided that now wasn't the right time for compromise, because if a compromise is found now, they're going to look weak, and it's going to look like they've got the worst end of the bargain, which is great in Brussels and bad in London. So I think the comments which we've had from Michel Barnier over the last 48 hours about both sides needing to compromise, about the legal documents being drawn up, etc., these kind of minor concessions is an important PR move. Because at the end of this, the most important thing, I think, as far as both sides are concerned, is they need to be seen to have been the victor. And obviously both sides can't be the victor, but you can strike a good free trade agreement between both sides, come to an agreement on all different fields, which most people aren't going to read into too much depth on, and walk away saying that you've got something good at the end of it. The EU needs to make sure that other countries and people in other countries know that this has not been an easy venture, and that the UK is worse off. But the UK also needs to sell that they have made a success of Brexit, and they can move on striking new free trade agreements like the one signed with Japan today. And I think, like I say, the PR game is extremely important. I've never been pessimistic throughout this negotiation. I've been the kind of eternal optimist that a deal's going to be struck. And at times I've kind of felt a bit alone in that, because it feels like people have been growing more pessimistic. But I don't think I've been more optimistic than I am right now for a very long time.
Really?
I feel like this kind of spat has kind of cleared the air. And it feels like with both sides now acknowledging that mutual compromise is needed, it now lays the foundation for them to actually compromise and not lose face. And this was the problem before, by the EU suggesting that it has to be the UK that has to compromise and the vice versa, someone was going to lose face. Now there's an acknowledgement that they can mutually compromise and get a good agreement between the two. And I feel like that now lays the groundwork for it to actually happen. I think both sides were standing their grounds on areas when they knew that ultimately they were going to have to shift, both of them. And now that I think they're going to be able to, and I think we're going to see a lot of progress now in the next few weeks, and an agreement will eventually be signed. And I think no deal odds have shrunk after what, again, seems such a small, minor, petty difference, I think has actually resulted in a huge leap forward.
Is that reflected in the currency movements at all yet?
In a weird way, yeah, but in a weird way, no. So yes, in that we have seen a little jump in the pound. So I think that has shown that there is a little bit more optimism, but there wasn't a much of a decline in the pound when the talks were called off. I feel like this week's have been a bit of a boy who cried wolf moment as far as the pound is concerned. We've had 4 years of officials telling us that no deal is okay, that they manage it, there's worse for the other side, that they're ready for it, they're prepared, etc., etc. And the markets have been extremely jumpy. There was no jumpiness this last couple of weeks. And I think it's kind of been realised that we've had 4 years of this, and they always find an agreement at the end of the day. We always move on to the next stage, and we've not had no deal yet. And I think there's been this underlying confidence that, okay, this is just a spat, they'll come back to the drawing board at some point. And that's exactly what's happened. And maybe that little jump that we've seen in the pound over the last 48 hours is kind of a reflection of what I've just said. Ignore the noise, ignore the ridiculousness, ignore the petty spats that we see happening in the media. And now you can actually see that a real step forward has been made. Again, off something petty, but that enables compromise to be had, where it was very difficult before when it seemed that one side was driving compromise from the other.
And do you think that if there wasn't COVID-19 as the backdrop to all this, there would be less room for compromise? But both sides realise, and maybe more so the EU in this situation, that they have to do a deal because we're in enough trouble already without making it worse.
I think this is bigger than COVID-19, in that I think a deal, an agreement, and more importantly, something that, again, Biden referred to last night, it's about alliances. And we do not want a bad relationship with the EU, and the EU doesn't want a bad relationship with the UK. And I think that was always the driving force behind why a deal was always going to be reached. It was the economics are important, but these two nations can continue to trade on less good terms if need be. But I think at times like these, I feel like the alliance between the two is far more important. And that's probably the main reason why I've always been convinced that that there was always going to be an agreement at the end of the day, because united, they are far stronger than they are apart. And I think that's kind of now, yes, the COVID situation has made it more economically important. It was always economically important, but this has made it even more so, and it makes it even harder to justify as well a no deal to the wider public. But I don't think it's made the dramatic difference, because I think underlying these negotiations, there was always something far more important than just economic benefits.
Okay, before we ask Ed to look ahead to next week, Craig, I just wanted to have a quick note from you about these figures from Barclays, which has reported profits more than double the forecast, £1.1 billion, much higher than the £246 million of last year. And that will buoy certainly some of the banking shares and other financial services stocks in the markets. And I'm wondering whether that might have an effect to a certain extent on the USA as well. But what's your reaction to those figures?
Yeah, so going into European earnings season, that is obviously a massive plus. It kind of carries on a trend that we've already been seeing in the US over the first couple of weeks of earnings season, especially amongst the banks. We've seen lower cash put aside for bad loans, and that was quite consistent again with what we've seen in the US, and considerably so. So I think that was a really important factor in the upside surprise as far as Barclays are concerned, the kind of the market side of things, because we've seen that volatility has been a big contributor as well. So I think this is now seen as a pattern that's going to extend across the Atlantic and that we're going to see across European banks as well. But there's still considerable risks. We've got to remember as well, we're also comparing to last year when there were significant impairment charges as well on Barclays. So the comparable is always going to be slightly difficult in that situation. But it does give you some hope going into earnings season that it's not necessarily going to be as bad. But that doesn't mean that these massive headwinds don't still exist. We are still heading into a significant second wave, so the impairment, the money, the cash being put aside for bad loans this quarter may not be so bad, but that doesn't mean that next quarter is going to be much better. That it's not going to get worse. And also the kind of consumer side of things as well, you can imagine may not be quite as good as well. People have continued spending in here in the UK. Retail sales are actually higher than they were pre-pandemic. But when you start to see the kind of state aid being withdrawn, and we see obviously with the furlough scheme and we see unemployment start to rise, that can't continue. So that's going to take its toll, say, on the credit card business, etc. as well. So I think the results are encouraging, but there's real significant headwinds over the next two quarters. And therefore, I don't think we should be getting too carried away.
Over to you, Ed. Now, I mentioned look ahead to next week. Of course, the countdown to November 3rd will continue. I suppose Joe Biden's just got to keep out of trouble and stay in his basement.
Well, I think right now you're going to see both candidates are going to campaign as much as they can. They're going to be hitting those battleground states as frequently as possible. But I think they both know what they need to do to win votes. And I think President Trump is not really going to deviate much from his strategy, and he's going to just kind of focus on the economy. And I think after that debate, when many Americans were asked as far as who do they feel more comfortable about the economy, it's still President Trump. I think that you're going to see that climate change, racial inequality, coronavirus and foreign policy, Biden has the clear advantage, but the economy is what the president can try to change the focus to, and we'll see how successful he is.
It's amazing, isn't it, though, Ed, that when you think about it, all the trials and tribulations that Donald Trump had to go through from 2016 onwards, when you think about the impeachment process, problems with the various accusations with porn stars and all the other stuff that's gone on. And he survived all of them until coronavirus. And if he loses, it will be COVID-19 that did for him, really. Because the economy was doing well before COVID-19. It's come along and it's wrecked his plans, hasn't it? Because with the economy doing well and no COVID-19, I firmly believe he would have won the election. I'm not saying it's definitely all over, but it's looking that way at the moment.
Very much so. I think in January, I was a firm believer that President Trump had an easy path towards re-election. Just looking at the field of candidates, there was no one to be fearful of. And Biden is not, he's a flawed candidate. This is his third go at going for presidency, and COVID-19 is something that he thought he had a handle of. It, he thought it would go away. It didn't. The first wave, I think he would have gotten a pass for it. The second wave, not so much. The third wave, I think Americans are frustrated. While yes, progress has been made on the vaccine and treatment side. I think an optimism is high that the vaccines will be in place by the first half of next year. That's still not good enough because of the lack of support to many of the Americans. There's still over 20 million Americans receiving some type of benefit, unemployment benefit. So I think there's still a strong case here for Biden, and I think there's just not enough time to change the story. I think the one big event, though, that many people are going to be talking about, I think on Monday, is U.S. Senate Republicans. They're going to have that confirmation vote for Judge Amy Coney Barrett. And this is to fill a RBG spot on the Supreme Court. And this is going to be a monumental moment for, I think, the trajectory of the Senate. Because after that confirmation vote, Biden has clearly stated that he's going to, expand upon his position as far as what he's going to do as far as about expanding the Supreme Court. And I think that that could be the biggest risk event to the Democrats winning the Senate back. There are, I think, many Republican voters that are leaning towards Biden or are committed, but they don't want to give up the conservative majority on the Supreme Court. And I think that you would see that possibly, especially in those battleground states, you're going to have possibly them vote for Biden, but not for the Democratic senators at play. And I think his stance on whether he'll expand the court is really going to dictate that decision for many voters. So that's going to be Monday, and that's going to be a big event, and we'll probably hear from Biden later in the week. With regards to the rest of the week, Thursday is a huge day. Thursday we have, and I'll go in the order of these events, but we have the ECB rate decision, and while no change in policy is expected, the clouds are darkening over Europe, and I think that you're going to see ECB President Lagarde is going to have to acknowledge the weakness that is persisting and become a little bit less optimistic. And what everyone's going to look for is she going to provide a cue as far as an increase in the asset purchase program? So I think many people are going to be waiting to see how much that pessimism is and whether or not we're still pricing in an increase to that in the December meeting, if not earlier. After the ECB, we have, as always, jobless claims, and more importantly, though, we have the first reading of U.S. Q3 GDP. This is going to be the record-breaking rebound. This is following the 31.4% contraction we saw in the second quarter. It's expected to rebound 32%. That is unheard of. It really kind of highlights, the shuttering of businesses and just the limited reopening that has gone through, and just the strength of the American consumer. Strong snapback here. That's going to be heavily dissected. That's a going to be the last major economic data point before the election, and I think that's going to be a big focus as far as the pace of growth and what direction the economy is heading in. Obviously, a stronger reading is, you can make the argument that's better for President Trump, and a miss would be supportive for Biden. And then, in addition to that, after the close, you have two big earnings results from Apple and Amazon. Everyone is, as I highlighted earlier, mega cap tech has not done terribly well in this earnings season. Tesla, yes, they had good results, but their shares are lower. Netflix are lower, and we'll see. Oh, what does Apple and Amazon have in store for us? And then on Friday, it's more earnings. We'll get some results from Exxon and Chevron, and that's important for the oil space. We're going to see exactly more guidance as far as production levels, job layoffs, and I think that continued weakness and consolidation, possibly acquisitions, are going to just be what everyone in the energy industry is focused on. So a busy week, and no, we'll happily recap it next Friday.
Ed Moyer in New York and Craig Earlham in London. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Was the OANDA podcast from the team behind Jazz FM's Business Breakfast, a daily early morning 30-minute briefing for the day ahead. On air from 6 a.m. Listen to Jazz FM on DAB, online, or just ask Alexa.